thank you very much and welcome to Radio Savannah, Mr. President.
Thank you very much, Mohsamed. BBC is still the station of the nation.
Thank you very much for the endorsement. Let me ask you, what brings you to the northern region?
Well, this is the final stop of the Accounting to the People tour. It's taking me through 9 regions of Ghana already, and the northern region is the 10th and final stop, and it happens to be my home region. And so I want to thank all Ghanaians of all walks of life, nurses, you know, teachers, you know, farmers, drivers, you know, all kinds of people who turned out in all the regions to welcome me. I want to thank the traditional rulers, religious leaders. We had a very beautiful interaction in almost every region that I have been to. We have been commissioning projects that we have completed. We've been inspecting ongoing projects. And we'll be interacting with the citizens of the various regions and looking at the challenges that they still face and planning how we can resolve some of the socio-economic infrastructural obstructions that we find in these regions. Yesterday I entered the northern region, and as a homeboy, it was like a homecoming. I want to thank all the young people who came out to meet me. I was quite frightened about some of the motorcycles.
Yeah, I was about asking you how you feel anytime you enter the northern region, having grown up here.
I cringe, you know, because with all the motorcycles you see, you know, accompanying the presidential convoy, you sort of have your heart in your mouth and you keep praying that, you know, nobody gets injured. But I'm happy that yesterday, I mean, there were no reports of any incidents. And when we gathered at Ababu Market, it's one of the most gargantuan, you know, gatherings that I have seen. And I want to say thank you to all the people who were there yesterday.
Now, you've been to 9 other regions before coming to the north. How has the reception been?
The reception has been very warm in all the regions that I've been to. And the people have felt very free to express their gratitude to government for a lot of the things that we have done. We've made significant progress in many sectors, in education, in healthcare, in rehabilitation of the road network, in electricity
access, in access to clean drinking water. In all those areas, we've made very, very important investments. And everywhere I've gone, the chiefs and people have expressed their appreciation for that. I did the Accounting to the People program in Accra. That's when the Green Book was published. And at that event, I did say that I'll be coming around the regions, you know, to showcase some of the things that we have been working on and to also interact with the chiefs and people and see what more governments needed to do and in what sectors.
I believe that the most important thing as a president you can touch is life. And since they say water is life, let me go straight to this issue of providing potable drinking water for the people of Ghana. Would you say that you have done quite well in this area?
Yes, we have. I mean, water is one of the areas in which we've made very massive investments, both in rural and urban water. If you go to most of the urban centers, in the past, yellow jerry cans were a very familiar sight everywhere with people going to look for water. Today, we've increased water delivery in all the urban centers. In Accra, we've increased water delivery by almost 53 million gallons more water is being pumped into Accra. And so traditionally, water-starved areas of Accra, which are mostly in the north part, like Kadanta, Madina, East Legon, and other
places. Because my own backyard in Accra, Ashalebuche, before I left, used to be a very peculiar place,
yeah.
Water-starved area.
Today, places like Ashalebuche, Madina, East Legon, and other places are all getting water. I used to live in East Legon myself. I moved out of East Legon because of the water shortage, and I moved to Jolu, where water was flowing. Today, if you go to East Legon, the taps are flowing because we've increased water delivery to the Accra metropolis by more than 53 million gallons a day. We've also set up the desalination plant that is processing seawater and converting it into potable water. That is also delivering
13 million gallons of water a day to the eastern part of Accra, Teshin, Nungwa, Labadi, and other areas that also used to be water staff today have access to clean and safe drinking water. But that is only urban. In the rural areas, we've done hundreds of small town water systems everywhere. And just this store I did in the upper east and northern region, I commissioned 11 rural water systems, small town water systems in the upper west region alone. In upper east, I commissioned the Boku Water Expansion Project. I commissioned the Navrungo Water Expansion Project. Just yesterday, I commissioned the Targu Water Expansion Project. And today I'm going to be in Zabzugu to commission the water expansion project. These are just a few of the hundreds and hundreds of small town water systems that we have done. Indeed, we've moved access to safe drinking water. And today, Ghana leads in West Africa in terms of access to safe drinking water. We've moved it from 58% in 2008 to 76% urban and rural water. And our intention is that by the grace of God, by 2021, we expect that we should be able to achieve universal coverage for access to safe drinking water. By 2025, that's the target. The target is 2025. But by 2021, I think we would have gotten closer to our goal of universal access to safe drinking water.
Yes, because I was just about putting in this, that we still have communities in parts of the country. For the northern region, I know Damango, your own backyard, if I may put it that way, still have challenges with water.
Yeah.
You are going to the Eastern Corridor today. Possibly you meet the Kampakuyana. He's been talking about the Yendi water system. There's this talk about connecting the OT because the Dakar is dried up.
Yeah.
What are your plans for them?
Yeah, we have a design for the Yendi system, and we've secured finance, and it has to go through the procurement process, come to cabinet and go to parliament to do the Yendi water expansion project. We've also done the design for the Damango water system. We're looking to do a pipeline from the Black Volta and draw the water about 21 kilometers to Damango so that Damango has a safe, a reliable source of water. Currently, we're using the borehole system, but the town has expanded so rapidly, and the boreholes in that area are not as productive as you find in other parts of the country. And so during the rainy season, they have sufficient water, but during the dry season, the water table goes down, and so it's not able to deliver enough water to Damango Township. And so we have a design for Damango. So that's why I'm saying that we have done hundreds of small town water systems, but there are still many more that we need to do. I don't say that I have suddenly provided all Ghanaians with water. We've moved water coverage, like I said, from 56% in 2008 to 76%. And that is a significant jump. It means that 7 million people more are receiving water over this period of time. From independence to date, the number of Ghanaians receiving clean drinking water was 14 million. From 2008 to date, we've added 7 million more to that number of 14 million. And so there are some more Ghanaians that we need to cover, and we'll do that over the next period of our administration.
If you've just joined us, you're live on Radio Savannah 91.3 and also live on Unique 95.7 in Accra and across all GBC regional FM stations. My name is Mutala Issa, and we're privileged to have here today His Excellency, the President of the Republic of Ghana, John Dramani Mahama. Now, let's move to agriculture. The northern region is largely an agrarian region, and I understand that over 40% of the Ghanaian population is actually involved in this. But over the last few years, we understand that agriculture has not done very well, growing below 1%. Would you say you've done well in that area?
I don't know why people bandy the wrong figures about. You know, when the figures are published every year, when the budget is presented, the growth rate for agriculture in 2015, end of 2015, was above 2%. And yet I hear a figure of 1% or something being bandied about, you know, for political gain. It was not 1%. Growth in agriculture has been positive, and it has been good, and we're looking to push it even further. I think that agriculture should be growing at about 5 to 6% per annum in order that we can achieve the target of becoming food secure. But we have moved agriculture one step further. If you go around the country, the agricultural infrastructure that we're putting up to assist farmers, we've increased rice production, we've increased poultry production, we've increased aquaculture production. We have increased production of roots and tubers. There's more cassava. There are more yams. We're exporting yams. You know, we've increased a lot of food crops in this country. But like I'm saying, we are not satisfied with 2.4% yet. We must be growing at 5% to 6% in order that we can make Ghana a net exporter of agricultural products. We have set up mechanization centers to assist farmers in respect of access to plowing services. We've done three waves of supply of agricultural mechanization equipment, tractors, harrows, plows, trailers, and all the like. Just as I speak, there are 500 more tractors we've received from Brazil, with all the accompanying equipment, planters, fertilizer distributors, threshers, harvesters, combined harvesters for rice farmers. We brought all that in to assist farmers to be able to increase their production. And once you give farmers that support, they rise up to the occasion. As I drove across the country, the rainfall has been good. I have seen beautiful crops coming up, groundnuts, cowpea, and everything, you know, across the savannah zone. But we realize that in order that we are able to achieve food security, we must increase the amount of irrigable land that is available so that we don't have to absolutely depend on rainfall. And so we are rehabilitating more than 15 irrigation dams that were abandoned in the past. And we are even commissioning new ones. In the Upper West region, the Tamni Dam is an important dam to the people in the Boko Garu Timpani area. It was surveyed in 1962. In 1978, the feasibility study for that agricultural irrigation project was done. It is only 3 days ago that I cut the sod for work to start on that project. And that is just one of about 14 different projects that we're doing. We are rehabilitating the Tono irrigation project. We're rehabilitating the Via irrigation project. There's an irrigation project in Brenham in the Brongahafu region. We've rehabilitated that. That is going to bring about 1,000 hectares of land under cultivation. Tamni is bringing 3,250 acres of land under cultivation, and it will be used to produce onions, pepper, you know, sorghum, maize, rice, and all the like. We've increased rice production to 60% of national consumption. All these are major forward steps in terms of agricultural production. Aquaculture has gone from 3,000 tons to 40,000 tons of fish is produced in aquaculture. That is positive growth in terms of agriculture. And the figure of growth for agriculture in 2015 is above 2%. It's not 1.7% as is being bandied about. But in any case, in 2007, agricultural growth was negative. It was minus. And so if we've gone from minus...
Why are you taking us to 2007?
No, I'm just telling you. Okay. We've come from minus 1.7
okay.
in 2007
okay.
to 2.4 okay. in 2015.
Okay.
That is positive growth.
Now, I also travel around the country quite a bit, and everywhere I go, what I see are old men riding their bicycles, and they are basically those involved in agriculture. My generation have virtually turned their back on agric. What steps has your government taken to ensure that the young people of this country, the youth of this country who are crying for lack of jobs, get attracted to this industry?
Agric is becoming attractive. And we want to recapture the glory days of agriculture, especially in the savannah area. When I was a young boy growing up in Tamale, a lot of young people were involved in agriculture. And if you went to your friends' houses at the weekends, most public servants and all were gone to their farms. Everybody had a rice farm or a maize farm or something. And the income they generated from the farms was more than their aggregate income from their jobs for the whole year. And so there was a strong incentive, you know, to go into agriculture. What we need to look at the value chain. Young people are not interested in going to take a hoe and cutlass and go and bend their backs in the sun and do that laborious kind of agriculture. But if you provide modernized agriculture with mechanization services and things, the entrepreneurial young people who are interested in going into agriculture, we're seeing it in the cocoa industry. We have the youth in cocoa farming. And 2 years ago, if you remember, on 7th January, on my anniversary, I spent the day with a young cocoa farmer, Samuel Tobin, in the central region. I spent the day with him on his cocoa farm. And Samuel Tobin is in his late 20s. He finished secondary school in Takrady, and then he came back and took over his parents' cocoa farms. At that time, they had 8 acres. He has increased it to 27 acres. He's able to make enough money to look after himself. He's bought himself a car. He's put his children in the best schools in Western region, and he's making progress. It's the same here. We are seeing an increased interest by young people in agriculture. When we did the Youth Enterprise Support Program, many of those who opted to take part in that program went for agricultural projects. There's a woman, a young woman, who got the YES support, Youth Enterprise Support Initiative support, and she went into aquaculture. Today she employs 20 people. She is the employer, and she employs 20 people, and she's selling fresh fish, different species of fish, to many restaurants in Accra. I mean, that is the spirit of entrepreneurship we want to spark in our young people. Young people are going into cashew growing. Young people are going into growing of various kinds of food crops. And I think that it's an area that will continue to be attractive to them. But like I was saying, we need to look at the full value chain of agriculture, from the farm gate, post-harvest preservation, to markets. One of the major problems has been the value chain, the markets. If you produce the crops and it's not taking off you, then it becomes a problem. So one of the things we're doing is setting up what we call farmer service centers, and we're going to establish the first one before the end of this year. We've targeted to start phase one with initially 50 of such centers. They register all the farmers in the catchment area where the services center is, and provide the farmers with all the inputs they need: fertilizers, improved seeds, pesticides, agricultural extension advice, and mechanization services. They'll plow for them, they'll harrow for them. If it's rice, they'll harvest for them. There'll be combined harvesters. Each center is going to have 10 tractors. It's going to have two harvesters. It's going to have threshers, everything that a farmer needs. It will even be a microfinance center. And so if a farmer needs 200 CDs, he'll go to his center and borrow it. When he harvests his crops, he can pay the center back. And I believe that that is going to be a huge revolution in agric. What we haven't done over the years is dedicated support to the farmers, organized in a cooperative manner. Once we register all the farmers in the catchment area, they will see that center as theirs, and they can go there and ask for any services that they want, and those services will be delivered.
I'm happy you are talking about support to farmers. Quite recently, let me give you an example. I was in Taha. Taha is about 10 minutes ride from where we are sitting now, and we met with some farmers. Apparently, their tractor, only one old tractor they were using. And when we interacted with them, they said subsidies have been coming, support has been coming to government, but it ends up in the hands of political activists, and the farmers on the ground do not actually benefit. Are you aware of this, and what steps are you taking to ensure that farmers actually get what they are due?
You see, the way we've organized it in the past has been mistaken. We bring subsidized tractors and ask farmers to come and buy. And so the farmers who can afford buy, they plow their fields, and then they charge others to plow their fields in a very disorganized manner. And so what we're saying is, farmers do not, every farmer doesn't need to own a tractor. You don't. If you have tractors available for which you can have the service, then that is what you should be bothered with, not the fact that you own the tractor yourself. And so if we have a center where these tractors are available, we've already set up some mechanization centers across the country. We had 57 mechanization centers. That has increased to 89. But these are tractors that were given to individual farmers to provide mechanization services. Now, these farmer services centers I'm going to talk about are going to be fixed franchises that are run by people, and they would have a guideline that they should operate by. If they don't follow the guideline, the franchise will be taken from them and given to somebody else. All the operators of the tractors are going to be trained. All the people who work in the center are going to be trained on the services that they need to give the farmer. So this is going to be more dedicated support than we have seen in the past. And I believe that this is the way to go. All the countries that have been successful in green revolutions have taking the path of dedicated support to farmers, not these shot in the dark, you know, approaches. We brought several waves of tractors. Today, most of those tractors have collapsed or are broken down, and that is because operators were not even trained how to service those tractors. In many occasions, I see tractors go to a filling station, and the oil that vehicles have changed, the dirty oil, is what the operator buys and puts.
They actually call it dirty oil.
Yeah, they call it
the
dirty
farmers
oil.
The farmers call it dirty oil.
He goes and says, I want dirty oil.
Yeah.
And they sell it to him, or sometimes they give it to him free because, of course, you go and dispose of it. And so he puts it in his tractor. Now that tractor in 2-3 years will be broken down. And that is the tractor that we spent so much foreign exchange to bring. And so we're changing that method. And that's what I'm saying. These farmer services centers would service the tractors there. They would have trained operators who know how to operate the tractors. The suppliers of the tractors will have mobile vans and they'll come to the farmer service center and repair any tractor that is broken down. It's going to make a very big change in agriculture in this country. We are already seeing the results in terms of agricultural production. Like I said, rice production in 2008 was 301,000 metric tons. In 2014, it almost doubled to 604,000 metric tons. These are real figures. These are things that are really happening. With poultry, we came with what we call the poultry revitalization project, and we are targeting 20 million pieces of broiler. We're not producing broiler in Ghana before. But now you have the KFC, you have the fast foods that prefer the broiler chicken. And so many poultry farmers have been given support by the Export Development and Agriculture Investment Fund to expand their poultry production in order that we can feed the markets with poultry and cut down the amount of poultry we're importing.
How are you linking agri with industry?
That is the link we need to do. That is in terms of agribusiness and agro-processing. And so while we do the value chain in terms of producing the crops, we must move the next step to processing those products by value addition. For instance, we're producing cashew, raw cashew, and Indian buyers are coming and buying the cashew and exporting them in the raw form. This cashew goes to India. It is cracked. It is processed into nuts. The nuts are exported to Europe at a much higher price than the raw nuts were bought from Ghana. Indeed, I believe that in some cases, some of those roasted nuts from India will find their way back here.
And they are almost a luxury, just
exactly,
like
that we will buy, you understand? And so two people have set up factories to process cashew nuts. And that was why the Ministry of Trade had attempted to restrict the export of cashew nuts so that the factories can get enough of the nuts. But we need to look at what the fundamentals are and see what is constraining the factories from being able to compete with the buyers, the foreign buyers who come and buy the raw nuts. And once we solve that bottleneck, then it means that we should be able to add more value to our products. Aside from that, we also do import substitution, and that is the reason for the Commander Sugar Factory, the new Commander Sugar Factory.
Is it working?
It is working. It's producing sugar. What happens is we did a survey at the time the factory was about being completed, and we realized that there was just a little over 11,000 tons of sugar cane that had been produced within the catchment area of the factory. Most of this sugar cane was being produced and sold to Apetashi distillers. And so once the factory was ready, we had to make the farmers aware that there was an off-taker that would take all the sugar cane that they were able to produce. We announced the price at which the factory will buy it. The factory was paying the farmers for transporting the sugar cane to them. Now, what we've done is to backward integrate the industry, that is, put in place the factory and assure the farmers that there's an off-taker so that it will create an incentive for them to provide to produce the sugar cane. Somebody would say we should forward integrate, and so go to the farmers and let them produce the sugar cane. And so if you go to a farmers and they produce the sugar cane, sugar cane takes 6 months to produce. If it's ready in 6 months and there's no factory to take it, how are you going to convince the farmers next time to grow sugarcane again? And so we put in the factory. Now we have the factory. This is the rainy season. I commissioned the factory. I told the farmers, this is how much the factory is buying sugarcane. Anybody who produces the sugarcane would have a place to sell it. And from the calculations we made, a farmer can make 2,500 cedis per acre of sugarcane. And so if you calculate that 2,500 cedis per acre, you know, then you can understand how lucrative it is to go into sugarcane farming. Maybe if I got some land in that area near the factory, if I did 100 acres of sugarcane times 2,500 cedis, that's 25,000 Ghana cedis. That's quite a load of money.
Now, Mr. President, I grew up in a small village called Menisu on the Eastern Corridor. And as a child, what we used to do was to, after school, wait on the roadside during the rainy season, fill potholes and push these cargo trucks with yam, so we get some yam to eat. But recently, having passed there, I use the Eastern Corridor, I have to say Menisu, Pepesu, KJB is tarred. However, large portions of that road remain unconstructed. What are you accounting to the people of Ghana with regards to the road sector?
With the Eastern Corridor, it stretches from Temaran about all the way through the Volta region into Northern region and then into Upper East. It ends in Kulungungu. All the segments that is within the Volta region are currently being engineered. We have contractors who are on the road and working. And so what we're doing is creating an alternative corridor, north-south link. We want to create three corridors. The Eastern Corridor, the Central Corridor, which exists already and is the most popular route for traveling from north to south, and then also the Western Corridor. And so currently we're engineering the Eastern Corridor. And so when we finish, you can come from Kulungungu, that is in the Boku East District, the extreme east, almost in the northeastern border with Togo. You can come through Kulungungu and come through Garu Timpani to Nakwanduri. And then from Nakwanduri, you come through Gushagu Yendi and come to Bimbila. And then from Bimbila, you go down to Otidamanko, through Nkwanta, come through Jasika and KJB to Hohoi, to Have, to Asikuma, to Atimpoku, to Asuchari, and then down to the Tema Runabout. And then you are on the motorway to Accra. So that is the length of that corridor. And I must say that it was divided into, I don't remember if it was 6 or 7 lots, but on all the other lots, work is going on. It's left with just the Nakwanduri to Kulungungu stretch. You are aware that Nakwanduri to Otidamanko, Odebrecht, are working there, and they're making quite significant progress on that road. Between Otidamanko and Nkwanta, you have one of the Chinese companies working. And then Dodi Pepesu to Nkwanta has been completed.
Done, yeah.
And so that is in place. Below Dodi Pepesu, that is from Jasikang, we have put Rolida. Rolida did the whole Fume Road, and they finished it. So we've made the move onto the Eastern Corridor. And so they are engineering below Jasikang. We expect that they'll go all the way to Hohoi. And then once you finish Hohoi, below Have, you have GS, it's also a Chinese company, working all the way to the Asikuma Junction. We hope that once this is engineered, we can open the corridor while we continue to engineer the other sections. When I went to Japan, the Japanese government restored our ODA, and the ODA includes a new bridge across the Southern Volta in association with African Development Bank to engineer the Asikuma to Atimpoku section of the road. And so I believe that with all the work that is going on, in the next above 12 months, we should have a much better riding surface on the Eastern Corridor and have more volumes of vehicles using that as an alternative route to the south. You know, a lot of the yams we eat in Ghana come from that part of the country. And the poor nature of the roads contribute to increased cost of transport, and increased cost of transport reflects in market prices. And so, of course, your children won't have the opportunity to push trucks out of the mud anymore, because that road will be a first-class road. But it will be a benefit to Ghana in terms of lower agricultural prices.
Now, let's move away from the Eastern Corridor. Can you tell us other major roads that you've tackled in this country?
There are many, many of those roads all over the country, indeed. just when I was in Upper East Region, the famous Bolgapoku Road is on the lips of every person from the Upper East. I cut the sod for that road. The contractors who were working on the Tamale Airport runway have completed, and so we've asked them to move their equipment onto the Bolgapoku Road, and so they're going to engineer that road. I also cut the sod for Chuchuga Sandima VAC Road, and we also have work going on the Chuchuga Tumu Hangwa Road. That road will open up the Upper East Region into the Upper West Region so that you can drive from Bolga or Navrongo safely to Wa without incident. We've also engineered the Sola for Foso Road. And so if you are coming from Wa to Tamale, you come through Sola and through Damango to Fofoso Junction, and then you turn left and then you come to Tamale. But the other routes we're working on, the Bosunu Daboya Road, and the intention is to push it through Mankargu and Lingbensi and bring it into Yagaba. That is what we call the overseas area. And from Yagaba, we can continue through to Fumbisi and then come out at Sandima and to Navrongo, so that that area will no longer be called overseas, because it was called overseas because it used to be cut off during the rainy season. When the White Water floods its banks, those areas were not accessible any longer. But today, with the roadworks that we're doing, we're opening up that area. And that area used to be the Onko Zone. And so it's sparsely populated. A lot of people migrated from there because of river blindness. Now that we brought Onko under control, there are thousands and thousands of fertile acres of land in that area. And so more people are migrating back to engage in agriculture. There's been a road from Kesi where you can go to Santenjan and then cut through to Welembele. And from Welembele, you come out at Wa. And so if we open that road and open it across the Michio Bridge to come out at Wali Wali, then you can come from Wa through the overseas area and come and hit the Bolga Tamale Road at Wali Wali and turn left or right in whichever direction you want.
You are making me dream. You are making me dream. However, to these places, and what the people tell me is that they will always come here during the election year, cast sword, and when we vote for them, they disappear. What assurance are you giving to those people that? Actually, the Bolga Boku Road, I passed there recently, and yes, I became a white man.
That's right.
It's quite a terrible road.
No, we finished the procurement. It's been awarded. You know, the company is a Brazilian company, and they are going to mobilize to site, and that road will be engineered. In most of these roads that I'm talking, the Chuchuga and Mawiesi Road, the contractor is on site and working.
Are they finishing, Mr. President?
Well, the for instance, Bolga Boku is 24 months. They're supposed to finish in 24 months. There are three major bridges over the Kula River, the White Volta, and the Red Volta that they have to build. There are 176 culverts that they have to build. And so that's quite a complex job. And so it will take 24 months to complete. Then we have a one-year defects liability period. And so the project has been awarded. And the point is, we have the money to pay because we have the Enhanced Road Fund. We're paying all this from the Enhanced Road Fund. And so there are several of those projects. Apart from that, we have the Cocoa Roads projects in all the six regions. All the contractors who are working, when they present a certificate this week, next week they go and pick up their check. And so all those road projects are going on. Gambia number 2 to Chemasu Road, the Mem Gosso Road. I mean, so many of the roads in that area that were neglected are being done. The road from Akontomra through to Seshuri, also the road that cuts through Brongahafu and enters Western Region. It goes through Nkankwanta and comes out at Adabokum. All those roads we're doing. From Elubo coming to Dadieso and Enchi, we're engineering the roads there. We've done the Aguna roads. We've done the gas enclave roads in the Nzema area. We're doing roads in all the major townships. We've democratized asphalt. Asphalt is not only in regional capitals today. In some of the district capitals, we're doing about 10 kilometers to 20 kilometers of asphalt overlay. We're doing it in Winneba. We're doing it in Swedru. We're doing it in Cape Coast. We're doing it in so many communities all over. Tunyani, we're engineering the outer ring road and the inner ring road. And work is ongoing. By next year, they'll be completed so that it eases congestion in Tunyani Township. In Tamale, your own city, we are doing the asphalt overlay. We're doing almost more than 50 kilometers of asphalt overlay in Tamale Township. In Accra, we're doing 170 kilometers. We're doing Tema, we're doing in Ashaman, you know. And so there's massive road work going on all over the country.
It seems to be your trump card, but your critics say that we don't eat roads.
Well, roads improve our incomes, and so ultimately we eat roads, because roads bring the yams we eat. And so if I just say literally, you know, the food we eat in our markets is brought to the markets by the roads. And so you might not physically eat the road as an item, but the road facilitates the food you eat. And if the roads are better, then it means that the food stuff will be able to evacuate more food stuff to the market centers, and that will affect inflation. It means that food inflation will come down. It will make food cheaper for our people. If we engineer the roads and the roads are better, we can evacuate more cocoa and export the cocoa and make more income for our country. We can pay our workers better. So ultimately, those roads would have translated into better remuneration for you. And so, I mean, for political purposes, people will say we don't eat roads. We don't eat hospitals. But if you are sick, you see the need for hospital. You eat the hospital, but it will make you well. We don't eat schools. But education is the most important thing that one needs, you know, to come out into the world of work. And so these social infrastructures, you can say we don't eat them, but the point is they make this country a better place, and they would be responsible for propelling our country into an era of prosperity.
If you've just joined us, you're live on Unique 90, Radio Savannah 91.3, and then of course on Unique 95.7, and of course across all GBC regional FM stations. We are also live on GBCGhana.com for those of you listening to us from across the outside of this country. And we are privileged to have in our studios today His Excellency President John Dramani Mahama on his Accounting to the People tour. My name is Mutala Issa, your host. Now we are moving on. Now every nation builds its economy by sound educational policies. Vocational and technical education, for instance, is key in nation building. Your government has been in power for nearly 4 years now. What are you accounting to the people of Ghana in terms of education?
Indeed, education is one of the areas in which we've made quite strong impact at all levels, from basic education through secondary to tertiary. And we are particularly promoting technical and vocational education, because we realize that the business and industry and the job market are looking for more middle-level skilled technicians and people of that caliber. And so we need to get more of our young people coming out of junior high school and senior high school to look at the technical vocational option, because there's a gap there that we need to fill. Of course, it's useful to go to the tertiary level, to go to university, because we still need, you know, a lot of manpower when it comes to the various courses that are done, administration, marketing, and all of that. But we must look at in what quantities we need them. You find that the people who are skilled today are more employable. For instance, if you are a plumber and you're a good plumber at that, or you're an electrician, or you're a welder, or you're a carpenter, or you're a mason, you're more likely to find a job because of some of the growth that is occurring in construction. If you look at all the construction that is taking place, that is in public works, like in the education sector, in the health sector, in the port expansions, in the road works and all that, you find that engineers and technicians, I go around the country and I see young engineers who just left University of Science and Technology, and they are the project engineer on a particular site, and they're wearing their, you know, construction helmets and their safety boots, and they're working, and, you know, and so I think that we must be looking at how we're tailoring our educational sector, like, and we're looking at it on the German model, you know, where technical and vocational education is emphasized so that you can create that kind of middle-level technical manpower, you know, to move the country forward. But if you take from tertiary right down to basic, the investment have been massive. All over the universities have gone. I mean, just recently I was with Otunfo in the University of Science and Technology, and we inaugurated two new buildings, the Faculty of Agriculture building and the Faculty of Pharmacy building. And their lecture halls, their offices, their telejectors, you know, the most modern auditoriums and things, you know, for lectures to take place. And these are multiple floors, 5 stories high. And that is just, if you go to all the polytechnics, we've re-engineered their workshops, we've built hostels, we've built administration blocks. If you go to University of Development Studies, we are building one of the most modern libraries for that university on the WA campus. We're building a lecture a hall complex, an auditorium complex. We're building a hostel block that can accommodate more students on campus. If you come to the secondary level, it's the same. All we're taking 150 secondary schools, and we're expanding the infrastructure so that they can bring in more students at the secondary level. So dining halls, I was in Fumbisi, we opened a new boys' dormitory there, and they have another boys' dormitory and a girls' dormitory coming up. They have a dining hall and kitchen and an administration block, and that is just one secondary school. Today we're going to Dabokwa under the DSIP program. 9 separate projects are taking place in the Dabokwa Technical Vocational Institute. And so these are just few examples. I could name so many of them. We've distributed means of transport, 300 buses, you know, to schools across the country, and pickups to district education offices, you know, both tertiary, secondary, all of them we've distributed vehicles to them. And so a lot of work has gone on in the education sector. But of course, the flagship project of my administration is the Community Day Senior High Schools. And what we noticed was that having achieved the Millennium Development Goals of universal primary education, we have more than 97% of children of school-going age going to school. And these are not my figures. These are MDG figures. The other time a politician was telling me it's not true. Of course, 3% are still not in school. And so we're using the compulsory basic education program to mop up the 3%. Some of them are shepherds in the bush. And so we're creating classes in the night so that in the night when they are not following the cattle, they can come to school. And so we're doing a mop-up for the 3% of children. But we have achieved in excess of 97% of children of school going age going to school. And we've achieved gender parity. As many boys as are going to school, girls are going to school. It's 1-to-1. And so with all these children coming through the basic education level, they end up at GHS. And after GHS 3, a lot of them do not continue into SHS because we didn't have enough space in our senior high schools. The total number of public secondary schools was about 500, private above 100. And so if you combine them, you had 600 and something secondary schools. And so all these children write the BCE. And we have to do a cut-off. And so it's not that they are not qualified, but we take just the quantity that the secondary schools can take. So the computer places those that the secondary schools can take. And so these Community Day senior high schools, 123 of them have been awarded on contract and are at different stages of completion. When they are all completed, they'll create another 184,000 spaces in secondary schools for Ghanaian children. And that means something. The first school I commissioned is the Atamils Ekumfi Otiam Community Day Senior High School. And there's a girl I brought to Parliament, Apim Shulamite. She finished junior high school, and she was not placed by the computer. So she sat at home for 2 years, helping her mother with menial jobs. She worked in a chopper, you know, selling water and all that. Today, that girl is the girls' prefect of the Otiam Community Day Senior High School. And that has changed her life. And so these, you might discount these things, but they make meaning to people's lives. And that's why I say changing lives, changing people's lives and transforming our country, because you can only transform a country when you change the lives of the people and change their lives for the better.
Now, recently I
95.7
in this very premises, where the former Northern Regional Minister Alhaji Libuna Muniru, he set up a committee to investigate the downward fall of the education in the northern region, and the report they came up with was not very good. Yes, access has increased tremendously, but then we also learning that so many of these children, for instance, in 2015, over 6,000 children dropped out before they entered JHS. Are you aware of this? What accounts for it, and how are you
UNIQFM
working to address these challenges?
We have more of the children going to school and more of the children staying in school. Of course, there's still a dropout rate, and we need the cooperation of parents to make sure that their children remain in school. Now, what happens if you look at the performance in the BEC? Ghana has consistently gone up in the BEC. Over the last 3 years, the first to third best results in West Africa have come from Ghana in the WAEC exams, and most of them girls.
Unique FM, simply the best, the best, the best, the best, the best, the best.
But there are pockets where we do have problems. There are schools where, in some cases, the performance is abysmal.
Improved. But there are pockets where we do have problems. There are schools where, in some cases, the performance is abysmal. And that's why everywhere I've gone, I've asked the community to take an interest in the school. We don't just have a school and believe that it's the duty of the teachers to do whatever they want to the children. The community must take an interest. And it has been proven over and over again that where the traditional rulers and the community take an interest in the running of the school, the performance of the children go up. And so the Ghana Education Service is doing its best. The ministry is doing its best. We're providing children with school sandals at a basic level so that they don't go barefooted to school. Some of them go in Charlie Watte and very miserable footwear. We're providing all the core textbooks. In the past, 4 children shared 1 textbook. Today, every child has 4 textbooks.
I used to be the captain of the Zongo school boys in Minusu, and I had 1 textbook and about 8 of us
shared with you. Today, we are printing those textbooks, and the beautiful thing is I have directed that those textbooks should be printed in Ghana by Ghanaian printers. In the past, they would have ordered them from abroad. I said, no, we have the capacity to print these books here. And so those books are being printed there. They're being supplied to the children. The children have their complements of textbooks. We're also giving them exercise books because realize that you go to a school and no child has an exercise book. The teacher is teaching. He cannot even write what the teacher is teaching. And so we're improving supplies to the schools. We've expanded the school feeding program. So in the areas where you have the school feeding program, you have almost 100% attendance every day because the children get 1 meal a day. Almost 1.4 million children are being fed every day, and we intend to continue to increase that number. You know, we're making schools under trees. So far, almost 1,700, you know, of those schools have been eliminated with new school buildings. And I don't say that we've eliminated all of them. They're still substandard schools. And so when people go and discover one school and say, hey, mama says it's eliminated schools under trees. Yes, a school under tree. I didn't say I've eliminated all, but progressively we'll continue to eliminate them until we make sure that every child in Ghana is learning under optimal conditions. But even when you've provided all the facilities, you have the teachers, you have the textbooks and everything, there is still a lot that needs to be done by the community to ensure that that quality engagement between teacher and pupil is happening. So government will do its part, but I believe that it is a joint exercise. The community must assist government to ensure that in every community that we've placed a school, you take an interest and make sure that the school is being run properly and that the children are benefiting.
I'm happy you mentioned the German model, which I have witnessed in terms of technical education. And your critics think that your conversion of polytechnics into universities contradicts that German model, which is strongly polytechnic based and technically based. Most of the polytechnics you are converting into universities now, around 80% of their courses are in the liberal arts, marketing, accounting, business. You think that you are doing the right thing?
Indeed, we have taken the bill to Parliament and we're converting all the 10 universities, polytechnics, into technical universities. And I have insisted that they must stick to their core mandate of science and technology courses being the majority of the graduates that they are turning out. And so we're going to be mindful of that, that from diplomas to degree courses to certificate courses in all manner of technical and science-based courses, they must form the majority of the curriculum that they run. I don't say that they shouldn't do liberal courses. You know, there's a need to provide some avenue for liberal courses to take place. But the majority of students, you know, running courses in these technical universities must be science-based and technology-based. And so the rectors of these new technical universities understand that. And I'm sure that the Ministry of Education is going to ensure that the balance is in favor of science and technology-based programs.
teachers, trainees and nurses, trainees have been crying for years now over your removal of allowances. I remember when I was in secondary school, it was one of the most attractive things. I wanted to go to a training college because I wanted to enjoy some of the allowance. That's what attracts most young people from the rural areas into training colleges. You have taken this out. They've been agitating. Are you looking at replacing it, bringing it back so they could enjoy? If not, what measures are you putting in place to make sure that life is comfortable for these students in teacher training colleges and nurses colleges?
Actually, there are two main issues here. One was an issue of equity, and the second was an issue of increasing the capacity of the colleges of education to allow more people to have the opportunity. Now, let me take the issue of equity first. We converted all these teacher training colleges into colleges of education. That made them tertiary institutions and degree awarding. Now, they produce trained teachers, you know, for the educational system, like their colleagues in Winneba, like their colleagues in University of Cape Coast, like their colleagues in Lagos. And so you had a situation where you were going to become a trained teacher, so you enroll in a university. The fact that you enroll in University of Winneba, you don't get allowance. But if you enroll in a college of education, then you get a training allowance. I mean, where is the equity in that system? And so students in University of Education Winneba take student loans, and then when they're employed, they are enjoined to pay back the loans they took. But then if you go to St. Mary's College of Education, then you don't take loans. Government pays you to study to become a teacher. So that was the first problem, a problem of equity. And so we said, you know, all trainee teachers, whether you're in Winneba, you're in Cape Coast, you're in St. Mary's Training College, you're in whichever college of education, should take student loans so that there's equity in whichever institution you go. The second was an issue of quota. Because of budgetary constraints in terms of paying trainee allowances, all the colleges of education were restricted to a certain number they could take. And so as a result of that, most of the colleges could not fill their campuses because of the quota. And so there are many students who wrote their exams and passed, but were not taken because there was just not enough space to take them. And so since we substituted, and I don't say we cancelled, we did a substitution. We have offered the trainees, the students loan, like their colleagues in the other universities. Since we did that substitution, admissions into colleges of education have gone up by 63%. Many of the teacher trainees who are in colleges of education today would not have been there if we did not substitute the training allowance with a student loan. And so it's not like government did it in a senseless manner. We did it so that we could give more students the opportunity, and more students are going on. I gave the example of one of the students from WA, you know, who after attempting twice to enter the College of Education and was refused, the year we substituted the trainee allowances with the student loan, he immediately got entrance. And so he was happy to have the opportunity to train as a teacher and get an employment and be able to pursue a career as a teacher. And so I just expect that our teacher trainees will understand what happened to these institutions. And so I want that.
Recently, there have been agitations about the cleaning of the voters' register. Are you in favor of it? What's your take on the Supreme Court ruling on the national use of national health insurance cards to register?
As president, I don't interfere in the work of the Electoral Commission and the Supreme Court. I think that the two institutions, I have enough issues to deal with without taking other people's issues on my head. And so you've not heard me comment about, you know, the voters register or the Supreme Court ruling or anything. I think the two institutions are good enough to be able to handle the issues. Institutions are not tertiary institutions. And so it means that you cannot apply student loan to them unless you amend the Student Loans Act. And so this committee has it, and that makes them able to go through their courses. With the student loan scheme, it restricts it to tertiary institutions. And many of these institutions are not, it's an issue to it.
Recently, there have been agitations about the cleaning of the voters' register. Are you in favor of it? What's your take on the Supreme Court's ruling on the national use of national health insurance cards to register?
As president, I don't interfere in the work of the Electoral Commission and the Supreme Court. I think that the two institutions, I have enough issues to deal with without taking other people's issues on my head. And so you've not heard me comment about, you know,
the Supreme Court's ruling on the national use of national health insurance cards to register.
As president, I don't interfere in the work of the Electoral Commission and the Supreme Court. I think that the two institutions, I have enough issues to deal with without taking other people's issues on my head. And so you've not heard me comment about, you know, the voters register or the Supreme Court ruling or anything. I think the two institutions are good enough to be able to handle the issues that confront them. We have an EC that is well respected, and I believe that they'll do the right thing. I believe that with the advantage we have in terms of biometric registration and verification, you understand, even if you didn't have a register that was perfect, and I don't believe there's any register in the world that is perfect, but with the added features of biometric registration and verification, I believe that even if there are names on that register and we are vigilant at the polls, nobody can use them to his advantage, because we will all vote with our fingerprints registered. So I believe these institutions know how to work these things out. I have enough work on my plate to do, and so I'm not going to carry anybody's responsibilities on my head.
Well, Your Excellency, I want to believe that this is how much time we have for this today's encounter. We hope that we could continue all day, but we do believe that we will get the opportunity again to interact with you. Let me just give you a minute to say something in Gonja Dagbani before we leave.
Umba Numpo, Northern Region, Nirbaza, Dasva,
Asankushunga
means thank you very much.
Thank
in
you
Ne tuma pam, and Dagbani means thank you very much.
All right. Mr. President, we have a surprise for you. I understand you have a favorite song. And if my technical man is listening to me now, please, can you drop it? Well, I have been speaking to the President of the Republic of Ghana, President John Dramani Mahama, on a wide range of issues on Radio Savannah Tamale on 91.3. We have also been live on our mother station. Well, the song is in now.
Hello?
You know the song?
Yes, Shatawale. I think it's Shatawale's song. Mahama Pepa. What the song meant. And he says, Mahama Pepa is our currency in the city. And that all of us spend it, and so we must protect it, we must. That is a lovely song.
I want to thank you very much, Mr. President. And on behalf of the people here, call me General. Have a wonderful day.